Here's the state of the play. As you know, there is another huge push for regime change happening, right now. Huge push. Netanyahu went to Mar-a-Lago on December 29th, pleading with Donald Trump to bomb Iran, and this time to bomb Iran's ballistic missiles, to bomb Iran's proxies, and effectively support a regime change war. This has been going on now for over a month. Shortly after that, there were these massive protests in Iran. Now, as I've said since the beginning of the year, it is very important to understand precisely what is going on here. These are not protests, okay? That's not what that was. People are calling it a spontaneous uprising in response to economic conditions, the collapse of the currency, run on one of the state-sponsored banks. That was merely the pretext. The situation in Iran is that for years, Israel has been conducting industrial sabotage. They are bombing Iran's factories, oil refineries, ports, their electrical grid, their vital public infrastructure. The United States has waged an economic war on Iran. These maximum pressure tariffs have prevented Iran from selling its oil at market price, prevented Iran from doing trade with Europe and the United States or any of our major trading partners. And so this has put Iran in a situation. Their people have experienced rolling brownouts, unreliable electricity, water, shortages of essential supplies. Their currency has never been weaker against the dollar. This is a situation which has been manufactured. You understand this, right? Imagine if in the United States, every week and every day, there was an unexplained explosion at our factories, our meatpacking plants, on our farms, at your electrical grid, at a power plant. And imagine if your grocery stores weren't stocked, the shelves weren't stocked every day. And imagine if you turned on the faucet, there was no water, and you turned on the lights and there was no electricity. Well, understandably, people would be angry. People would grow tired of that. They would grow restless. And imagine if that was being inflicted on your country by an outside force. You wouldn't say that, oh, well, you know, the people just decided to get up and riot one day. You would say that this is effectively a siege. This is a modern day siege. This is like the city is surrounded. The people are starving. They can't get anything, and they're being hit with flaming arrows every day. They're being hit with flaming rocks every day. That is what is going on. Simultaneously, Israel and the United States are backing operations inside Iran. What happened during the six-day war with Iran last June, or excuse me, the 12-day war? What happened during the 12-day war between Israel and Iran last year? Israel didn't just bomb Iran's nuclear facilities. They also bombed Iran's internal security service. Why? Because in the event of an uprising, an insurrection, a protest, a foreign-backed uprising, it would be the internal security service that would put it down. It would be the internal security service that is looking for Mossad and CIA agents and hanging them. It would be the internal security service that is looking for the truck bombs and for the shipping containers that contain drones or missile launchers. In the event of an insurrection, it would be the security service that is responding to these coordinated attacks. So Iran's internal security was degraded heavily in the final days of the 12-day war. Now, what happens in the first week of January, while Netanyahu is at Mar-a-Lago, Netanyahu is there at Mar-a-Lago pleading with Trump to bomb Iran. All of a sudden, you get this spontaneous uprising. They say it's because the economy is bad. But do you know what else is happening? In the west of the country, for the most part in the west, you have, and this is reported by reputable sources like the Financial Times and others, you have reports of men clad in all black with fully automatic rifles storming government buildings. This is happening in Iranian Kurdistan, which borders Iraqi Kurdistan. Do you know what's happening in Iraqi Kurdistan? Well, the United States is moving all of its troops from Baghdad to Iraqi Kurdistan. The U.S. isn't leaving Iraq. They're just going to the Kurdish part of Iraq because that is the part of Iraq that is semi-autonomous, effectively self-governing, independent from the central government in Baghdad. And the U.S. has bases there. The CIA, the DOD has made inroads there. They have allies there, and so has Israel. The Kurds are the closest ally of Israel and the United States. They're also bordering Azerbaijan, which is an ally of Israel, longtime intelligence and military supplying ally, Israel and Azerbaijan, Israel and Baku. So Iran's border with Azerbaijan and Iran's border with Iraq in the West is being flooded, is effectively being invaded by all of these operatives wearing all black, carrying automatic rifles with a plan, taking over government buildings. Now, what do you think this is? This is a systematic, multi-year regime change war. They got Trump elected the first time to rip up the nuclear deal so that we could destroy them with sanctions. And then Israel came in after the deal was ripped up and started doing industrial sabotage, sabotaging infrastructure. All this time, we have been furnishing the Kurds and Baloch separatists, Israel and the United States, with weapons. And so now that we have destroyed their nuclear facilities, the two vital facilities in their nuclear complex at Natanz, Fordo, also Esfahan, now that that nuclear hedge is sufficiently weakened, now we're bringing the real economic pain. Now we're bringing in the ground force. What is going to be the ground force that overthrows Iran? Combination of Kurds, Baloch people, Turkic people, maybe people sympathetic to the old regime, the Shah, liberals, what students, young people. That is going to be the ground force. And by the way, that was the same playbook in Syria. Exactly the same playbook. Do you know what happened in 2007 in Syria? In 2007, Israel suspected that Syria was working on nuclear weapons. So Israel launched a unilateral airstrike and they bombed Syria's nuclear weapons facilities. 4 years later, you get the Arab Spring, which starts in Tunisia, spreads across Libya, Egypt, then it goes right up into the Middle East, into Syria. And that's when the U.S. and Israel start funding Al-Qaeda, start funding these Sunni extremists that just got finished with the civil war in Iraq. We start funding Al-Nusra Front. We start funding the Peshmerga, the Kurds. And that was our ground force. The U.S. was the air force. ISIS was the ground force. Al-Qaeda was the ground force. The Kurds were the ground force. And all the while, again, first, Israel took out their nuclear hedge. Then it was the insurrection, which was the ground force. Then it was the U.S., which was the air force, coupled with the crippling sanctions on the economy and oil. And that's how Syria in 2007 is solid under the Assad regime with a chemical and nuclear weapons arsenal, goes to a civil war in 2011, and the government is overthrown by December of 2024. It's the same playbook in Iran. Bomb the nuclear hedge, maximum pressure economics. We're going to now fund the ethnic separatists, these ethnic and religious minorities inside the country, the rebels, the moderate opposition that opposes Islamism, and we're going to be the Air Force. That's the play. That is what they're building here. That's the move. So Netanyahu comes to Mar-a-Lago for the fifth time. We need a war with Iran. What a coincidence. Just in time for the uprising, just in time for the most violent uprising since 2022, since the Green Revolution 15 years ago. And what made it the bloodiest revolution? It wasn't the biggest in scope. It wasn't the biggest in number. This was the bloodiest protest because it was effectively an invasion. It was masked, uniformed operatives armed, storming Iranian government buildings to overthrow the government. And it looks like Iran shut it down. What did Iran do? They just started shooting these people. They put it down like they always do, violently. They crushed it. And you know what else they did? They shut off the internet. Now, curiously, when they shut down the internet, the whole thing stopped. Do you know who the internet provider was? It was Starlink. Elon Musk, one of the biggest defense contractors in the world. It was Elon Musk's Starshield, which is an extension of its Starlink program, was providing satellite internet to the protesters. Okay, so where's all this coming from? Where are the weapons coming from? Where's the internet coming from? Where is the economic pressure coming from? It's coming from here. It's coming from Washington. It's coming from Tel Aviv. Now, the protest was crushed. As you know, it was claimed that Trump was moments away from authorizing a strike on Iran. The jets were in the air. The bombers were in the air. We were ready to go and bomb Iran. But the strike was called off at the last minute. Why? Well, what they said is that we didn't have a big enough force package. We only had a few destroyers off the coast of the Middle East. I believe in the Eastern Mediterranean, although I'm not exactly sure the precise location. You had about a half dozen ships, including three destroyers. And that was not enough in terms of radar, early warning system, missile detection, but also in terms of Minuteman missiles, Patriot batteries, also in terms of an Air Force. We did not have enough defensive and offensive capability forward deployed to engage Iran in any kind of protracted conflict. And otherwise, in other words, one, if we attacked Iran, it wouldn't be a killing blow. With only a handful of destroyers and the existing presence in the region, we could not launch a killing blow against the Iranian regime. And if we couldn't take them out, they would retaliate. And their retaliation would have been catastrophic because without warning, without Iran restraining themselves, we would have no way of knowing which targets they would strike, when, and whether they would use hypersonics, whether there would be some kind of forewarning. And we can't defend the whole Middle East at once. We can't defend all of Israel and our bases in Jordan and Syria and Iraq and Qatar and the Emirates. We can't defend the whole Middle East from a surprise missile attack, especially if it's overwhelming. So it was said that Trump called off the strike at the last minute because it wouldn't topple the regime, and therefore it would lead to a retaliation, which we were not equipped to defend against. Now, what is the implication of this? The implication is that Trump is apparently now seeking regime change. They buried the lead. Trump said, well, I was going to bomb Iran, but it wouldn't do regime change, so I called it off. And we're supposed to say, what a relief. My question is, regime change is the policy now? That wasn't the policy a year ago. That wasn't the policy during the election. In the 2024 election, he said no new wars. A war with Iran is a pretty substantial war. It's three times the size of Iraq. It's got a population of 90 million. They have a 1 million man army. They've got thousands of missiles. They've got a navy. They've got a pretty serious arsenal. So Trump said during the election, no new wars. I guess regime change is now on the table. That's what we're planning. Even in 2025, when we engaged Iran, we engaged with them diplomatically over their nuclear program. We said, listen, we want Iran to be integrated into the economy. We want to normalize relations. And we said, you can even have a nuclear program. We said, the only thing is you can't enrich. We said, keep your missiles, keep your proxies, and as a matter of fact, keep Bushehr, keep your nuclear power plant. We said, but the enrichment needs to be overseen by us. So you can do it in Saudi Arabia, you can do it in an island, you can't do it there. And we bombed them, apparently, nominally, ostensibly, because they wouldn't give it up. And Trump declared victory because he said, well, now Iran can't enrich. So that is why that was heralded as a success. That was the pretext for it. They said it's their nuclear enrichment capability. Now it's regime change. So you go from no new wars to, well, we need to bomb their nuclear enrichment, otherwise it's fine, to now, well, we can't bomb them because it wouldn't succeed in regime change. And at what point was that determination made? I guess that determination was made during that meeting. I guess Netanyahu made Trump an offer he couldn't refuse, because that is where that decision was made, at least on our side. As I've told you, Israel has sought regime change from the beginning of the Iranian regime, but apparently this decision was made that we're going to act on this recently. So Trump called off the strike because we didn't have enough guns. Well, then Trump sought to remedy this. So we are sending a carrier strike group to the Middle East. That's three destroyers and the USS Abraham Lincoln aircraft carrier, F-35 fighter jets, other strike aircraft. 50,000 soldiers, personnel are in the region right now. Military transport planes, cargo planes, refueling aircraft. We're moving in THAAD systems, Patriot missile batteries. We're putting a ton of force in the region, offensive and defensive capabilities to confront Iran. Now, the USS Abraham Lincoln just arrived in this theater of conflict last week, the closing days of January. It got as far as the Gulf of Oman, and Trump issued an ultimatum. Trump said on Truth Social, if Iran does not accede to our demands, then we will topple the Iranian regime. And the demands are, Iran has to limit the range of its missiles such that they cannot reach Israel and reduce the number of missiles. The other demand is they have to stop all their support for their proxies, like the Popular Mobilization Force in Iraq, Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas in Gaza, Palestinian Islamic Jihad in the West Bank, the Houthis in Yemen. And lastly, most importantly, they would have to give up their stockpile of highly enriched uranium, give up their centrifuges, disclose the locations of the remaining nuclear facilities, and have the IAEA come in and oversee their dismantling. These are the most maximal demands possible. We're effectively telling Iran they must make themselves defenseless. Iran is defiant. They say absolutely not. Well, it looks like Iran called Trump's bluff. Trump actually withdrew the USS Abraham Lincoln from the Gulf of Oman back to the Arabian Sea. There were some developments today that were a bit contentious. A couple of Iranian boats tried to seize a U.S. oil tanker, but they failed. At the same time, an Iranian drone, a Shahid drone, was surveilling the USS Abraham Lincoln in the Persian Gulf, in the Gulf of Oman, and an F-35 fighter jet shot down that Iranian drone. So we shot down an Iranian drone, and Iranian boats tried to seize and capture a U.S. oil tanker. So it looks like we are on the cusp. We're locked and loaded. We have all these aircraft. We have all these defense systems in place. We have the carrier there. Trump has issued his demands. We have shot down an Iranian drone. But it all changed today when apparently there was a diplomatic breakthrough. And now Iran says that they are open to negotiating. Turkey, Qatar, Saudi Arabia pleaded with the United States for Washington to negotiate with Iran. They don't want a war. And so these countries were begging us not to go to war. And it's pretty clear why. These are status quo powers. Turkey, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Pakistan are now forming a loose confederation with each other and with Iran on the basis that they are defenders of Islamism, on the basis that they are countering Israel, maybe countering the influence of the United States as well. And these countries are getting together and they want to stabilize the region. They don't want Iran to fall apart. Think about, for example, Saudi Arabia's plan. under Mohammed bin Salman, they have a new plan that by 2030, they want to make the kingdom a destination for tourism. They want to make it a technological hub. They want to make it a transportation hub. Why? Because oil is going out of style. Oil is becoming cheaper, not more expensive. People are transitioning to renewables and other forms of energy. And Saudi Arabia knows that if its economic future is bound up with oil, that they can expect decreasing revenue in the future. The U.S. is now the number one oil producer by far. Russia's number two. We're discovering new energy all the time. There's this huge transition happening, getting us away from combustion engines and towards electric in China, in the United States, in Europe. So Saudi Arabia wants to transition from a petrostate to an economy based on tourism, technology, transportation. Well, it's hard to attract wealthy people and tourists if there's missiles hurtling at your country. If Iran implodes and there's a regional war and the Houthis are lobbing missiles at the eastern oil fields, at the eastern province, if they're lobbing missiles at Riyadh, if they're lobbing missiles at the Line and Jeddah Tower and at Dubai, this is bad for these countries. So they don't want that. They're trying to stabilize. They're begging the United States, please don't go to war with Iran or we're screwed. And every country has their own stake in this, but they made their appeal to Trump not to go to war. And so they scheduled a negotiation for Friday. It will be another indirect negotiation, just like last year. Last year, there were five rounds of talks between the special envoy, Steve Witkoff, and the Iranian foreign minister, Araghchi. And these were held indirectly in Oman, in other countries. And the way they did it is they had the negotiators in two different rooms and they had intermediaries pass the messages along. The Iranians insisted, and it came from the Ayatollah, that the negotiations could not be direct. So like those negotiations, these will be indirect. They will be mediated by those countries, by Oman, Turkey, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the Emirates. Initially, they were going to be held in Turkey. Now, apparently, they're being held in Oman. And there's some particularities about these negotiations. So again, the way that all of this started last year, you have to think about the various positions here. So what is Washington's beef with Iran? Our problem is their Iranian nuclear program, specifically their ability to enrich. And what does that mean? They take uranium, they subject it to this process. And when they achieve, I'm not a scientist, okay, but when they enrich it to a certain level of purity, they can use it in a nuclear bomb. So it is Iran's ability to refine plutonium and enrich uranium, which without observation and supervision, without oversight, they could, if they so chose, build a nuclear arsenal. Now, the U.S., as the guarantor of world order and stability, facing no challenge from a great power rival, our biggest fear is that some revisionist power, some rogue state, will get a nuclear bomb, they'll get a deterrent, and then they could destabilize the world or threaten the United States. So we don't want any country to have this ability unless they have extraordinary U.S. oversight and assurances. So we don't want them to have enrichment. That's our red line. And that was a negotiation last year. We came to Iran and said, look, we don't want to talk about your missiles. We don't want to talk about your proxies. We don't even want to talk about nuclear energy. We want to strictly focus on enrichment. We said, keep your nuclear power plant, keep your other stuff, but you can't have highly enriched uranium and you can't have centrifuges. If you want to operate centrifuges, you can do so, but you got to do it somewhere else. Somewhere where we can watch over it and we can shut it down and we can control the flow of the enriched uranium. And it was their refusal to give up their ability to enrich, which led to the war last year. Well, think of the starting point in the negotiations now. Trump's demands now concern three different files. There's the missiles, there's the proxies, and there's nuclear. We are now telling them you can't support the proxies, you can't have your missiles, and you can't have enrichment. Iran is not going to agree even to negotiate on the other things. For them, it is a red line to even discuss that. It's just not on the table. Iran will not even entertain the notion that they would ever stop supporting their proxies, that they would ever give up their missiles, because they see that as this enormous imposition. Iran has a right to defend itself. Israel is an aggressor. And in the end, Iran's missiles are the only deterrent from Israel attacking it. Iran's proxies are a deterrent, and they're a part of Iran's public diplomacy and their foreign policy. So they don't even want that to be a part of the discussion. But that is what Trump started with. Trump said, this time, you got to give up the missiles, give up the proxies and enrichment. And Iran said, no way. No, that's not even on the table. Well, now they've agreed to negotiate. Why? Well, it's interesting. Steve Witkoff went to Israel today to speak with the Israelis, and he left that meeting and said, we only discussed nuclear. He said, when we met with the Israelis today, we didn't talk about missiles. We didn't talk about proxies. We only talked about nuclear. And so it seems that going into these negotiations, the United States has agreed that we will only talk nuclear. We're not going to talk about the other stuff. And on that basis, diplomacy can begin. And the Ayatollah has given approval to the president, Pezeshkian, who's a moderate and arguably a reformer. The Ayatollah has given the president permission to authorize these negotiations under the condition that they only be about the nuclear, that they are not direct. Again, it's going to be indirect. And that these negotiations, just like last year, they're actually just a framework for future negotiations. These are the games that are played. So this negotiation is about other negotiations. They're going to sit down on Friday to talk about if they're even going to talk at all. And they're going to gauge whether the U.S. is going to push them on everything or just nuclear and what they're willing to give. Now, we find ourselves in the same boat that we did a year ago, exactly a year ago. In February of 2025, Netanyahu came to the White House. I think it was actually February 4th today, 2025, that Netanyahu went to the White House and asked us to bomb Iran. And Mike Waltz was pushing us to do it, and Trump said no. And ultimately, when Netanyahu came back in April, Trump said, you know what, we're going to negotiate, we'll give them 60 days, and if they don't make a deal, then we'll bomb them. And we played this game last year. The first and second round of negotiations were exactly like this. They were held in Oman. Witkoff and Araghchi met, and it wasn't even a real negotiation. It was a framework. In the first and second round of negotiations last April, they met in Oman. They met indirectly. The Ayatollah was trepidatious, but gave the green light, and the foreign minister came out. And in those first two rounds, they said it was productive. We had a great meeting. We feel very good about it. But those two meetings were about the framework for future meetings. In other words, they didn't even talk about nuclear. They talked about what they were going to talk about. They said, are you going to only talk about nuclear? Yes. Okay. Are you really acting in good faith? Yes. Okay. And by the time they got to the third meeting and they actually sat down, they found out that they had irreconcilable, intractable positions. When they got there for the third meeting last year, Witkoff sat down and said, you can never enrich uranium, non-negotiable. And Iran said, well, we're never giving that up. It is our right to enrich. We fought very hard for it, and that's our red line. And it didn't go so well. Then we did a fourth one, same thing. Then we did a fifth one. It got aborted. We rescheduled it. It came together. Very bad. Then we went to war. Actually, scratch that. Then Israel went to war. Israel triggered the war by launching a preemptive attack on Iran. They got shit on for 2 weeks, and then we were forced to come to their rescue, hit Iran, finish the job, and then hold everybody in restraint. That was how the first war went. Well, here we are again, locked and loaded, making demands. We have a framework for negotiations. But it's like I said last week, here's how this is going to play out. Our position has not changed. We are giving these maximalist demands. No proxies, no missiles, no this or else. At the end of the day, though, our sticking point, our final price, is you cannot enrich. And that's their sticking point, too. And if anything, they're more dug in on it than they were before. Because what has taken place since the last time is that we did a sneak attack on them. Under the aegis of negotiations, we got them to lower their guard so that Israel could bomb them, which Trump then said he knew about the whole time, and he tricked the Iranians intentionally, and then we launched a sneak attack on them. And after this, Iran expelled the IAEA negotiators and swore they would never negotiate with us again. Well, here we are. If anything, it's worse than it was before. I said this last week. Even on the offhand chance that these negotiations succeed, okay, think of it. The U.S. and Iran are coming to the table in Oman, and they've got their partners with them too. They've got Egypt and Qatar and Turkey and Saudi Arabia, Pakistan. All these countries are urging both sides to de-escalate because nobody wants this war. Well, nobody other than one. And so the U.S. and Iran are sat. They've got all their friends with them. There have been some new developments that have changed the landscape in the Middle East, some notable ones, which we could get into. The U.S. does not want a war with Iran. And the reason being is because we really can't win a war with Iran. If we go to war with Iran, it's going to be long and drawn out, and we're going to bleed, okay? Soldiers are going to die because Iran is going to bomb them, and we won't be able to shoot down all the missiles. And Israel is going to be paralyzed because their country is small. They can't have missiles raining down on them every day, and they won't be able to shoot them all down. And what are we going to do? Just launch airstrikes? You can't airstrike Iran into submission. You can't airstrike Iran into regime change. It just doesn't work. You need to have some kind of ground force there. So it's going to be, in a word, complicated. It will not be quick and dirty. It's not going to be quick and easy. It's going to be very unpredictable. It could be very protracted and messy and bloody. And it's a midterm year. So this is difficult for Trump. He doesn't really want to risk it. We are here in February. If this thing goes on, it's going to hurt him in the polls. So Iran doesn't want to be destroyed. The U.S. doesn't really want to go to war because we can't win. We want a deal. They want a deal. Maybe there could be a creative solution. Who knows? Like I said last week, it's going to be difficult, maybe impossible, for U.S. and Iran to build rapport, to have a rapprochement, to negotiate some solution that we could both live with. However, and here's the catch. Even on the offhand chance that we are able to trust them or for them to trust us, even on the offhand chance that we are able to cut a deal, do you know who's going to rain on everybody's parade? Israel. Because you know what Israel said after the meeting? They said, well, you can never trust the Iranians. So Witkoff meets with the Israelis. Now he's on his way to Oman to set up for this meeting. The Israelis say, well, you can never trust the Iranians, and we're really worried. We are afraid that the U.S. is going to make a deal that we can't live with, and we need them to not only give up enrichment, but also their missiles and their proxies. Because remember, our problem with Iran is the centrifuges. Israel's problem with Iran is the missiles and the proxies and the centrifuges. That's why Netanyahu asked Trump to bomb Iran in December. He wanted us to bomb the missiles. So Israel will find a way to spoil the talks. They will find a way to derail it. And how are they going to do that? False flag. How are they going to do that? Disinfo. They will launch a provocation of their own. Because you got to consider the limits of every country's negotiating position. Iran is controlled by the Ayatollah, by the Ayatollah. Iran has a president. Iran has a council of jurists. But sitting on top of all of it is the supreme leader, the Ayatollah. He's got the final say. And the Ayatollah doesn't trust the United States. The Ayatollah doesn't trust these negotiations, and he never has. And he doesn't want to give up enrichment. Now, if these talks are, let's say, unsuccessful, if there's any signs of doubt, maybe the U.S. or Israel does something that causes Iran not to trust us, they are very cautious. They could pull the rug. What's more, if Israel does something provocative, the Iranian people are going to be outraged, and the Ayatollah won't be able to continue to give the green light for the talks. So Iran does not have a blank check to make a deal. Neither do we. Deterrence is a factor. We don't want to lose face. There's all kinds of reasons why this is a very delicate procedure. And Israel, basically, they have an unlimited number of options to derail this and mess with it in some way. And that is my prediction. I think that there are two willing sides that want to find an off-ramp here. Iran knows that if it starts, it ends in them ultimately in chaos. And we know that if it starts, it's going to be unpredictable. We're going to take some shots. It's going to be difficult for us. We don't really want to do it either. This is Israel's endgame. Israel wants to drive us into a war so that we decapitate Iran, and then that is basically their last real enemy that is defeated. This is what Israel wants. And then that whole region, from Lebanon all the way to Iran, is completely destabilized. Lebanon is destabilized. Syria is destabilized. Iraq is destabilized. Iran is destabilized. And think of who the beneficiaries are. Israel and the Emirates and India and Greece and others, these are revisionist powers. Israel and the Emirates want Yemen to be in a civil war forever so that they could create a new country that they control. They want Iraq and Syria to be in a civil war forever so that they could create a new country that they can control. Same thing in Sudan. The Emirates, Israel, these revisionist powers in the region, they want Sudan to explode into a million pieces. They want a Druze state in southern Syria. They want a southern Yemen state, southern Yemeni state like there was 30 years ago. And they want that in Iran. Maybe they want a Kurdistan. Maybe they want to redraw the borders so you have Kurdistan that stretches from Rojava through Iraq into Iran. And maybe they want a Druze state in Syria, and then they want a Sunni state in Syria, and then they want to divide up the Middle East so that it is favorable for their geopolitical interests. That's their endgame. And they don't care how many people die. They don't care how many people are killed. They don't care about regional stability. They don't care about the price tag for the United States. This is their endgame. So people say, what does an America First foreign policy look like? I'll tell you what it looks like. Israel and the Emirates are hurting us. These countries want us to die and go bankrupt so that they can grow more powerful. We need to restrain both of them. Mohammed bin Zayed, Netanyahu, both need to be restrained. Trump needs to work with Erdogan, needs to work with, unfortunately, al-Shara, needs to work with MBS, needs to work with Doha, needs to work with Pakistan, and try to hold the Middle East together. Why? So that we can leave. We need a security architecture that Iran is integrated into so that the region can begin to stabilize. Yes, we actually want Syria to stabilize. We want Syria to be one country. We want Yemen to be one country. We want Sudan to be one country. We want Iraq and Iran to be one country. We want strong central governments that can control what happens inside their borders. We want peace between the countries so that it is stable. And if it is stable, then we can withdraw those 50,000 troops that are in the region. And we can focus on the Pacific, which is the Indo-Pacific, which is really the most important region. We can focus on the Caribbean. We have to be over there to babysit these people. We have to be over there to prevent this whole region from blowing up. Strait of Hormuz gets closed, catastrophic for oil prices. We have to worry about the emergence of Islamist fundamentalism again. So we should be trying to stabilize the region so that we could focus on the higher priority regions, the Caribbean and Latin America, the Pacific, the Arctic. These are the areas where we are being challenged. We are being challenged in Greenland, or will be. We are being challenged in the first island chain. We are being challenged in Central South America and the Caribbean. So, you know, if you want a very clear and nuanced understanding, people say, oh, well, you know, it's like Israel's causing all the wars. It's like Israel and the Emirates are revisionist powers that are overturning the existing order. Basically, they favor chaos. They want chaos, instability, conflict, because weaker countries can pursue opportunities in that environment. When there is chaos and conflict, that's when the Emirates can use its military and its intelligence, and they can use their money to pay a mercenary army to go and plant a flag on the coast of the Red Sea, on the coast of the Gulf of Aden. And that is how they develop a colony. That is how they develop an overseas colony. And that is what Israel is doing. Israel can take land in Lebanon. Israel can take land in Syria. Israel can gain new allies and weaken adversaries with all of this chaos. They can open up a front against Iran. If Iran has no missiles and no nuclear deterrent, and if the proxies are destroyed, then their airspace is controlled by Israel, and Israel can just bomb and degrade Iran's military with impunity. That just means fewer guns pointed at Israel. But then we are caught holding the bag, because we got to be there. If Israel is threatened in any way, they will unleash a nuclear bomb, and we can't allow that. So now we got to have our aircraft carriers there to make sure that everything goes according to Israel's plan. So Israel is driving us into the mud. We are being driven into the muck. We will die here. This is a graveyard of our fucking country. We'll be fighting in the Middle East for 50 years to make sure that Israel never gets threatened and goes nuclear. And in the meantime, we are losing in the actual regions that matter to us, like the Indo-Pacific, like the Caribbean. Those are legitimate interests for the United States. We need ships. You need to go to Taiwan to get them. The Caribbean, that's our neighborhood. If you have a Chinese shipping container missile launch platform in Cuba, that's a problem. That's a legitimate place for us to intervene. I don't want two carrier strike groups in the Eastern Med and the Indian Ocean. I want them in the Caribbean. I want them in the Sea of Japan. That's where they need to be. So anyway, that is the situation with Iran. I don't think that a war is imminent, but I do think a war is inevitable. We're going to have these negotiations on Friday. Who knows? Maybe there'll be a surprise attack before then. You never know. Who knows? Maybe that's the pretext. I think, however, that Trump is just bluffing. I think that the last minute call off was a bluff. I think that this is a bluff. I think that all of this is meant to extract a concession. And by the way, let me tell you something else. Trump sees the world as a chessboard. Everything is connected to everything else, like Nixon, like Reagan. And I'm not a Reagan or Nixon glazer, but I do admire their geopolitical thinking. What do I mean by this? Think of the timeline. Trump kidnapped Maduro in the first week of January. Then you get these protests in Iran, and Trump says, knock it off or you're next. And then we pull up with the armada. Well, this is the United States. Give up your nukes or else. Trump realizes that you leverage one into the other. What happens when you kidnap Maduro? There's a word for this. It's called deterrence. You are reestablishing deterrence. You're giving credibility to the deterrent threat. And what that means is, we sent an armada to Venezuela. We bombed some of their boats. We did a ground strike. We bombed one of their ports. We said, if you don't listen, you're finished. They didn't listen. We kidnapped their guy. You don't want that to happen. You don't want the United States to rappel down from helicopters and pluck your guy out of the Capitol and take him to the United States. So we reestablished the credibility of our deterrent threat. In other words, we made a promise and we kept it. Now other countries will believe us when we make a threat. We made a threat. We followed through on it. Now, when we bring our armada to Iran, and similarly, we say, obey us or else, and we start shooting down drones, and we start doing things, now they're going to take that more seriously. And so properly understood, this is a continuation of what happened a year ago. It's a continuation of what happened in 2020 between the U.S. and Iran. Now, again, that is how Trump plays. That's how he negotiates. The wrench in all of this is that Israel is always forcing our hand. Maybe that's a good strategy, and maybe that there's a logic to that. However, the trouble with brinksmanship, going to the brink of war, playing a game of chicken, is that when you have a third party like Israel who wants to see the war, well, they are going to sabotage the game. If the game is to persuade Iran that they are miscalculating and we will bomb them and they will die and the Ayatollah will be kidnapped and so on and so forth, so they better comply. If that is the game and we're trying to extract that without going to war, well, Israel is going to try to create uncertainty. And they're going to try to drive the U.S. and Iran into a situation where they have to go to war. And that is what that is what Israel did last year. That is what they tried to do in 2024. They did this in April and July of 2024 when Biden was president, when they bombed the IRGC in Damascus, when they killed Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran. And they did it in June of 2025 when they launched their preemptive strike on Iran. So that's always the rub. People say, well, trust the plan. This is brinksmanship. Trump is a genius. And I think that is what he intends to do. But you have this third party, which is very interested in all of that failing and to get a real war. So I think that's the situation. I think that Trump is bluffing, but that doesn't mean we're out of the woods. Trump is bluffing. He did deploy, and it's not a super carrier. It's one of these older carriers, the Lincoln. It's only one. It's not two. And that doesn't mean it's not a lethal force package, but it's not as big as it was, and it's not enough to finish the job. Arguably, we don't have enough of anything to finish the job. I mean, you know, if Iran starts lobbing missiles out, we're kind of just cooked at that point. So I think Trump intends to bluff, and I think Iran is going to try to buy time, but I think Israel is going to try to sabotage. That's the great game. Iran is buying time. The U.S. is looking for an off-ramp, but might be forced to pull the trigger. These other countries are trying to resolve this. All these, like I said, this what they're calling the Islamic axis, Egypt, Turkey, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, they're trying to make this peace happen, but the revisionist power, Israel, they're trying to blow it all up.